Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the April 11th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The Pub with No Beer by Kevin Berry. He hadn't noticed the voices at first. In the endless stretch of the afternoon, he entered the pub through the side door with a soft, hushed aspect, as if broaching a place of burial. It was late March by now, the clocks about to change, and the first heat of the year was intimated when he raised the blinds a few inches to allow the sunlight through. He did so as to show the place up. The effect of the light was to insinuate life. The motes of dust in the sunbeams were life. He opened the windows a fraction to freshen the air and looked out. The bay was filling on a neap tide, and the stags of Broadhaven thrust at the clear white skies in raucous appeal. "Softly, softly, turn the wheel softly," Michael Batt said. "Until I'm blue in the face, I'm telling that boy to turn the wheel soft. But will he listen to me? In my sweet hole he will. Boy took down ejittery from the mother's side. He sits in behind that wheel, and it's like he's wrestling a effing gorilla." The boy was long since raised and driving temperately. Long dead was Michael Batt, the father. But the corner stool at the bar was still vaguely Batt's terrain. At an L to it sat six companion stools to face the optics and the hung spirits arranged beyond the row of taps. The Cerberian taps, his own father had called them. For Cerberus, he would curtly explain, he who had guarded the gates of hell. At the other end of the bar was the curtained hatch to the back kitchen, then the sorrowful passageway to the jacks. He smiled at Michael Batt's words, the air of long sufferance that was hard practice for effect, the lines that were rehearsed as Batt walked the shore road toward the lights of the pub all those lost evenings ago. He stepped behind the bar and placed his hands upon it lightly and looked out to the room and moved his eyes slowly left and then slowly right across the empty stage of it. "Now," he said. He took up the cloth and dampened it in the sink and ran it along the bar top. He brought up a quiet shine. The intention of the polishing was to approximate soft labor. Daily, the bar top was polished to show its grain and the nicks and scratches of its great age. The pub had been his father's for the long shift of four decades. His father, in turn, had taken it from a bachelor uncle. For three generations behind this bar, much the same set of thick, knitted eyebrows had insisted on a semblance, at least, of decorum. The sunlight crept by slow inches across the floor. It was the moment, in more usual times, of the primary schools letting out, and he missed the high, excited chatter from the yard across the way. Neither loudness nor drunkenness in this bar room had ever been tolerated. "There is such a thing as a thoughtful pub," his father had always maintained. He rinsed out the cloth and left it by the sink and dipped beneath the bar and went down the passageway to the jacks. He stopped halfway along and put a palm to the wall to steady himself. A rising feeling in the lungs was endured, a kind of maritime swell. He believed it to be a species of panic, but it passed over again as quickly as the clouds off the North Atlantic passed. His phone pinged and he squinted to read a text. He spent half a minute, then tapping a careful reply to a worried aunt in the family WhatsApp group. Would she ever leave the house again? And would she ever get off the effing internet? The tread of his dependable step, the family listened for always. This was increasingly a burden to him. "It could be one of 42 things that's wrong with me," Frank Walt half whispered to a pint of Smithwick's. "It could be the stomach acid, it could be the pollen, and it could be worse than either, and of course it could just be the fear." Walt had lived until he was 2 days shy of 90. He had been some and 50 years dying. Walt had been a man for the low tables rather than a barside perch, an antisocial man who needed people. From the passageway, he looked back now toward the barroom, toward the lost voices. The 5 empty tables were lit in the afternoon glare. Continuing on, he entered with an apologetic air the realm of the ladies. He opened the window above the sink and sprayed the one toilet with Dettol. Bringing his broad face close to the mirror, he breathed slowly on it to make a fog, and as the cloud slowly dissipated, it showed the weary state of his aging greenish eyes. The little map lines of bloodshot, the twist of the nose, a Frenchman's nose, the foolish pride, the ageless vanity, the extravagant eyebrows of a disgraced Christian brother. He closed his eyes. A long, sensuous parade of lips had been painted in this mirror. "That particular dog comes at me one more time, and it's getting the queer end of the stick," Alice Nealon said. "Every night, 7:30, on the one walk I can effin' muster, the little bastard come at me, him with the long face out of the Sullivan Yard. Eat it, dog, come lollipin'. Next time I'll open the ignorant face on him." Always, she began her evening with a decorous half-pint of stout. It was followed by another, and then, after a pause for deliberation, she would announce, in a startled voice, that she would nearly chance a full one. 3 more would follow before the double Jameson at 11 that would send her to the door, rosy-faced and muttering darkly against the dogs of the vicinity. He left the ladies and entered the gents, and never in all his time had it smelt more passable. He opened the window anyway. He ran the taps. He flushed the toilet. He took the rubber gloves from his back pocket and changed the tablets in the urinal. He pissed on the fresh ones for good luck and ritual and laughed to himself gently. He laughed to himself frequently these times. There was a strange hilarity to the predicament. He had been closed now for almost 400 days. As he re-entered the barroom, 3 slow knocks sounded on the front door, followed by 2 rapid ones, as if a code were being employed. He went to the window and looked under the blind and saw a blocky man in late middle-aged face to consider the bay, the stags, the equinoctial sky. He did not recognize the man, but his mood turned quickly somber as he moved to the front door. An experienced publican is an educated reader of mood's nuance. It wasn't death, by any chance, that stood there. As he opened the door, the man turned to him with an owl's incredulous eyes and spoke lowly to inquire. "There's a cuckoo, hey?" "Oh, yeah, there is," he said, "in the bushes behind the schoolyard. He'll let you know all by himself." "Loud, all right. A throttle on him. Would you sell me a pint?" "I can't do that." The man let his jaw drop in an exaggerated vaudevillian way. "Are you not allowed to sell takeout?" "Some are doing so in the towns. I'm not. I have no stock at all." "Hard all times, all right. I noticed the window was open. I thought I'd chance it." "Well, there's no harm in that." "You wouldn't recognize me, I suppose." "No, but I'm trying to place you." It was true that he was. The stranger was fastidiously keeping the 2-meter distance, and he had to narrow his glance against the sunshine to make him out. The face had an antique bearing. It was somehow medieval. The clear, hard gleam in the eyes. These were eyes that might seek a quick killing. But he spoke pleasantly enough. "I grew up not far from here," he said. Age receded from the stranger's face then to allow an Ocasey be made out. A poor family from a sad stretch of the shore road they had been. One of those families that had broken up and trickled away in all directions. They'd left a wound of a house behind them. The gaping maw of the blank doorway had stood on the shore road for years as invitation to the miseries banked within. It must have been 3 decades since the family had lived there. Hadn't there been a story about the father gone mad? "Are you an Ocasey?" he asked. The man smiled broadly and parted his lips to show a proud battalion of remade teeth. "You'd be a long time stepping out from your own shade," he said, confirming the speculation. The afternoon conspired with its languors. The heron stood beyond time on the wreck-encrusted rock. The Okeshi peered across his shoulder into the gloom of the barroom.
"I'd take a whiskey," he tried.
"I suppose if I don't charge you for it." He turned from the doorway and crossed the floor of the barroom. His breath was coming more thickly now. He dipped beneath the bar and polished a whiskey glass that did not require polishing and set it beneath the optic to fill a single measure of powers. He was watched all the while and smilingly from the doorway. "I've no ice," he called out. "A drop of water? I don't take it." He brought the drink and placed it in the stranger's hand. "I don't remember which one you were," he said. "There were a few of you, I think."
"There were eight of us for children," Okeshi replied. "Your father would have put mine out of this place more than once."
"Is that right?" The man turned his face bayward again and bore down on the slow years, the decades. He sipped at the powers and made no comment on it. The world had grown so quiet in this season of eeriness. Down the long solitude of the shore road, across the new fresh green of the fields, upon the clear and boatless bay, there was not a soul otherwise to be seen. "One night, my father came home from this place trembling," Okeshi said. "I remember he sat looking into the fire, and I could tell that he could hardly breathe." Keeping his eyes fixed on the bay, letting them fill up with its springtime radiance, Okeshi dredged from the past a woman's voice, his mother's, and it was perfectly got.
"What's wrong with you, Joe? Wrong with you, for the love of God? Did he say something?"
"My mother worried over him all the time," Okeshi said. "His nerves weren't set right. He had what she called his spells."
"Well, I'm sorry, I don't recall any."
"Ah, you wouldn't. You wouldn't recall any of it. You'd have been away at the boarding school."
The greatest mystery is how others perceive us. The pub had been a respectable premises always, and he could not have imagined that the family was other than well-regarded. But he realized, too, that the charge of snobbery is often an astonishment to those so arraigned. Okeshi finished the whiskey quickly and held out his hand to offer the empty glass, but as he reached for it, Okeshi withdrew it again, as if playfully, and he did not smile. He just set it down on the stoop by his feet and turned and walked away. He re-entered the pub and locked the door. He sat at a low table in the guise, briefly, of a customer. He looked around the bar for a slow minute. No sing-songs, no recitals, no displays of romantic affection. This had been a house that favored schoolmasters, respectable farmers, country solicitors. The meagerness of his world closed in. In such a quietness, all was amplified. The veils slip away, the edifice itself might crumble. In late March of the year, the light was rawly new and revealing.
"He'd mind a mouse for you at the mart in Ballina," Tim Godfrey said. "A careful man, he would not be found wanting. Hard enough tack to have a father the like of that?"
He must concede that it had been. It was many years since Godfrey had haunted the premises, had across the low tables roamed a humorous gaze. Godfrey had been a Church of Ireland farmer from the Ox Mountains, transplanted by a peculiar marriage to the North Mayo Plain. From beyond the place himself, he could see it more clearly. True enough that his father had been a careful man. Growing up in the house of such a man, you could hear yourself thinking. Without a single word being said, you could sense that you were being measured for what tasks might be presented. The running of the pub was at slow length presented. He rose and went behind the bar and set a glass beneath the optic and poured himself a large Bushmills and diluted it with three or four teardrops of tap water. He drank it in a swoop and felt the slow fire descend into his belly. It was years since he had taken a spirit. The charge of its heat stirred him powerfully. He had felt the intensity of anger in youth. He had not wanted this place, but had allowed himself to be shaped to it. There was a resentment he had never quite named before. He shook his head against this feeling and came out from behind the bar and went to the window and raised the blind another fraction and saw the expanse of the bay and the stags of Broadhaven looming and the cormorant arranged gothically on the black glister of its rock. Time could not be measured in the usual ways. The markers of day and evening had fallen into disuse. Subtracted from his routines, he was no longer the full equation of himself. These afternoon visits to the pub were to simulate routine, but now they were failing. They were filling increasingly with the old, lost voices. He went to the door and opened it, leaned down to take the whiskey glass from the stoop where O'Casey had left it, but there was no glass there. He closed the door and locked it again. He sat at a low table. The sun was moving without regard and rounded the building, and suddenly its light filled the kitchen out back. He felt drawn to the light. He remained at the table. Voices swam around him. One entered the others. Fred Coakley's, Andrew Max, Tess Hennebree's. I've only two speeds of mood. Easy going, 10 mile an hour, or 150. I lose the rag altogether. I goes from naught to Hiroshima. What to be effing wrong with me? Would I eat? I don't know what I eat. Would you throw on a sandwich for me anyhow? I'm not saying I'd eat it, though it might steady the ship a small while. Your father should have been a priest, but didn't he have a brother one already? Two in the family would be kind of going to town on it. He was alone with the voices. He wanted to be away from them. He wanted to travel past himself and across the fields of the bay and beyond the horizon and into the equinox, into the light. Rising and gauntly now, he crossed the barroom floor. He went under the bar and into the kitchen. The kitchen always had been the sanctuary of the house. Draw the curtain and it was removed from the public view. Once in this room, he had seen his father weeping. Time unspooled, unreeled, angered by a customer, thrown perhaps by an intrusive comment, riled by some perceived slight, his father had withdrawn to this room and silently wept. To be a publican was a lifelong performance. People need steadiness, his father said. They want to look into the same expression on your face always. You've to arrange your misfortunate face for them. The look his father arranged for the barroom was tactful, indeed almost priestly. He had offered a place of calm and reprieve, or at least such was his intention. The sunlight that came through the kitchen threw its shabbiness now into awful relief. He closed his eyes against the sight of it. He tried to imagine another life, but could not. From the bar, a voice made imitation of the stuttering caller at the Bellina Mart offering some dubious charolais. 440, all the way home. Have you nothing about you at all? 440 once. Have it? 450? As the men laughed in response to the soft mockery, he was again a small boy. He sat on the bar counter with his legs dangling and a glass of Coke at his elbow, a packet of Tato's ripped open beside it. Perhaps he was 5 or 6 years old. The men were back from the mart. His father poured pints of stout until they were a third shy of the brim and lined them on the counter to settle for a little more than a minute before finishing them with a wristy flourish. The voices in the room were an easy conspiracy and had great warmth. The mart must have gone well. He was spoilt and fussed over as the son of the place. An old man told him he was to be fattened for the mart himself, to see what he would fetch. He knew already how to slap away and mock the comment. "Get up the road, Gertie," he said. The peat fumes and the stout opened the men's mouths for them. The Mayo team was a disgrace. There were fellows togging out who had drank the winter. The waft of Carroll's cigarettes and Majors. Pint bottles were taken down from the shelf for those who objected to the gassiness of the drought. Newspapers were folded over and the deaths column squinted at with sour interest. He knew that his father spoke to God in the night. Once he had heard his father whisper so in the night. His father told God that he was very proud of him and of all his godly works. A high tide sounded beyond, roughly and unseen, in heavy booms and deep answering echoes. And as the wind roared to his boy's mind, the stags were baying at the sky. Such was his world then. He was the prince of the room and invulnerable. He could not himself speak to God. He stepped from the kitchen and into the barroom and wrung out the cloth in the sink. The voices in the bar of more recent times had been an affront to him. They offered themselves baldly as affront. Their bodies were arranged barward in aspects of affront. The voices of recent times, he felt, were colored by avarice and vulgarity. He had come to that unfortunate age when he believed the young to be savages. He closed the windows and drew down the blinds against what light the March evening had mustered. Age wore down on him. The voices faded out and left nothing at all behind. He might sell the effing place yet. He left through the side door to walk by the water for a while. He could never sell to the price you'd get for it. There was barely a ripple on the bay. There were no people anywhere to be seen. There was, across the slate-gray water, a sensation of great silence, and now, somehow, of peace. The year again turned on its slow wheel. And now, from the book section of the April 11th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, How Everyone Got So Lonely. The recent decline in rates of sexual activity has been attributed variously to sexism, neoliberalism, and women's increased economic independence. How fair are those claims, and will we be saved by the advent of the sex robot? By Zoe Heller. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, some people predicted that lockdowns and work-at-home rules would produce great surges in sexual activity, just as citywide blackouts have been said to do in the past. No such luck. In November, a study published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine found that the pandemic had caused a small but significant decline in American sexual desire, pleasure, and frequency. It's easy enough to see how the threat of a lethal virus might have had a generally an aphrodisiac effect. Quite aside from the difficulty of meeting new partners and the chilling consequences of being cooped up with the same old ones, evolutionary psychologists speculate that we have a behavioral immune system that protects us in times of plague by making us less attracted to and less motivated to affiliate with others. Not so obvious is why, for several years before the virus appeared on our shores, we had already been showing distinct signs of sluggishness in the attraction and affiliation departments. In 2018, nearly a quarter of Americans, the highest number ever recorded, reported having no sex at all in the previous 12 months. Only 39% reported having intercourse once or more a week, a drop of 12 percentage points since 1996. The chief driver of this so-called sex drought is not, as one might expect, the aging of the American population, but the ever more abstemious habits of the young. Since the 1990s, the proportion of American high school students who are virgins has risen from 45% to 60%. People who are in their early 20s are estimated to be 2.5 times more likely to be sexually inactive than members of Gen X were at the same age. One partial explanation for this trend, versions of which have been observed across the industrialized world, is that today's young adults are less likely to be married and more likely to be living at home with their parents than previous cohorts. In the U.S., living with parents is now the most common domestic circumstance for people between the ages of 18 and 34. Even after accounting for these less than favorable conditions, however, the suspicion remains that young people are not as delighted by sex as they once were. Speculation about why this might be so tends to reflect the hobby horse of the speculator. Some believe that poisons in our environment are playing havoc with hormones. Others blame high rates of depression and the drugs used to treat it. Still others contend that people are either subliminating their sexual desires in video games or exhausting them with pornography. The dubious term sexual anorexia has been coined to describe the jadedness and dysfunction that afflicts particularly avid male consumers of internet porn. For the British economist Norina Hertz, the decline in sex is best understood as both a symptom and a cause of a much wider loneliness epidemic. In her book, The Lonely Century, published by Currency, she describes a world that's pulling apart, in which soaring rates of social isolation threaten not only our physical and mental health, but the health of our democracies. She cites many factors that have contributed to this dystopian moment, and among them are smartphones, the gig economy, the contactless economy, the growth of cities, the rise in single-person households, the advent of the open-plan office, the replacement of mom-and-pop stores with anonymous hyperchains, and hostile civic architecture. But she believes that the deepest roots of our current crisis lie in the neoliberal revolution of the 1980s and the ruthless free market principles championed by Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, et al. In giving license to greed and selfishness, she writes, neoliberalism fundamentally reshaped not just economic relationships, but also our relationships with each other. In illustrating its thesis, this book draws a wide array of cultural and socioeconomic phenomena into its thematic centrifuge. Hertz's examples of global loneliness include elderly women in Japan who get themselves convicted of petty crimes so that they can find community in prison. South Korean devotees of mukbang, the craze for watching people eat meals on the internet. And a man in Los Angeles whose use of expensive professional cuddler services is so prolific that he has ended up living out of his car. But is loneliness what chiefly ails these people? And if so, does their loneliness bespeak an unprecedented emergency? Old women get fed up with their charmless husbands. Kids watch the darndest things on YouTube. And men, as they have done since time immemorial, pay for the company of women. Yet still the world turns. Many books about the atrophy of our associational ties and the perils of social isolation have been published in recent years, but we continue to underestimate the problem of loneliness, according to Hertz, because we define loneliness too narrowly. Properly understood, loneliness is a personal, societal, economic, and political condition, not just feeling bereft of love, company, or intimacy, but also feeling unsupported and uncared for by our fellow citizens, our employers, our community, our government. This suspiciously baggy definition makes it easier to claim loneliness as the signature feeling of our time, but whether it's useful to conflate sexlessness and political alienation, or accurate to trace their contemporary manifestations to the same dastardly neoliberal source, is questionable. Disagreements about definition are at the root of many disputes about loneliness data. Spikes in loneliness were recorded after the JFK assassination and 9/11, raising the possibility that what people were really reporting to survey takers was depression. And even the most soberly worded research is liable to become a bit warped in its journey from social science lab to newspaper factoid. The figure that Hertz quotes in her first chapter, for example, 3 in 5 U.S. adults consider themselves lonely, comes from a Cigna Health survey published in 2020, which found that 3 in 5 U.S. adults scored more than 43 points on the UCLA loneliness scale. Scoring high on this 20-question survey is easier than you might think. In fact, if you answer sometimes to enough questions like, how often do you feel that your interests and ideas are not shared by those around you, you have a pretty good chance of being deemed part of America's loneliness problem. Given such caveats, 3 out of 5 seems encouragingly low. Sociologists who are skeptical about whether loneliness is a growing problem argue that much modern aloneness is a happy, chosen condition. In this view, the vast increase in the number of single-person households in the U.S. over the past 50 years has been driven more than anything by affluence and, in particular, by the greater economic independence of women. A similarly rosy story of female advancement can be told about the sex decline data. Far from indicating young people's worrisome retreat from intimacy, the findings are a testament to women's growing agency in sexual matters. In a recent interview, Stephanie Kuntz, a veteran historian of family, said, "The decline in sexual frequency probably reflects women's increased ability to say no and men's increased consideration for them." Well, this is a certainly jollier view of things than Hertz's Hell in a Handbasket account, but as several women writers have pointed out, reports of modern women's self-determination in sexual and romantic matters tend toward exaggeration. In The Lonely Hunter, published by Dial, Amy Lutkin, a writer in her 30s, wrestles with the question of how chosen her single life has been. The book describes a year in which she set out to break a 6-year spell of near celibacy by taking up exercise, losing weight, joining a dating site, and so on. The inspiration for this experiment was an evening with friends that left her feeling unfairly blamed for her loneliness. By the end of the year, she hadn't found a lasting relationship, but she had gone on many dates, had some sex, and even fallen unrequitedly in love for a time. So one might reasonably conclude that the cure for her loneliness had, in fact, been in her gift all along. She largely rejects this notion, however. To insist that any determined individual can overcome loneliness if she tries hard enough is to ignore the social conditions that make loneliness so common, Lutkin writes. In her case, there were strong economic reasons that she focused on work rather than on love for many years. She also pursued people who didn't return her affections. And some significant part of her loneliness came not from being single, but from living in a world that regards a romantic partner as a sine qua non of happy adulthood. Ironically, she suggests, celebrating single women as avatars of modern female empowerment has made things harder, not easier, for lonely women, by encouraging the view that their unhappiness is of their own making, the price they pay for putting their careers first or being too choosy. She notes that the plight of lonely, sexless men tends to inspire more public concern and compassion than that of women. The term incel was invented by a woman hoping to commiserate with other unhappily celibate women, but it didn't get much traction until it was appropriated by men and became a byword for sexual rage. This, Lutkin believes, reflects a conservative conviction that men have a right to sex. Is this true? A less contentious explanation for the greater attention paid to male sexual inactivity might be that it has risen more dramatically among young men than among young women in recent years. In a study released in 2020, nearly 1 in 3 men between the ages of 18 and 24 reported no sexual activity in the past year. What's more, young male sexlessness, unlike the female variety, correlates with unemployment and low income. Men's greater tendency to violence also probably creates greater public awareness. Female incels, however grumpy they get, do not generally express their dissatisfaction by shooting up malls. Nevertheless, Lutkin is surely right that women's authority over their sexual and romantic fates is not as complete as the popular imagination would have it. As to explain why 1 out of 4 single American women hasn't had a sex partner for 2 or more years, and more than 1 in 10 haven't had a sex partner for 5 or more years, researchers have cited women's aversion to the roughness that has become a standard feature of contemporary porn-inflected sex. If, as Stephanie Kuntz suggests, women feel freer these days to decline such encounters, that is, of course, a welcome development, But it's hard to construe the liberty of choosing between celibacy and sexual strangulation as a feminist triumph. In a new collection of essays, Love in the Time of Contagion, published by Pantheon, the film studies professor and cultural critic Laura Kipnis argues that women are still far from exercising enough agency in their sexual dealings with men. For her, the decline in sex is one of several signs that relations between men and women have reached an impasse. Just as the death rate from COVID in the U.S. unmasked the enduring inequalities of the American political system, she observes, the At Me Too movement exposed that heterosexuality as traditionally practiced had long been on a collision course with the imperatives of gender parity. Kipnis credits the Me Too movement with unleashing a lot of hatreds, some of which were warranted and overdue for an airing, and some of which she believes were overstated or misplaced. Her exhilaration during the early stages of the Me Too movement curdled, she reports, when conservative elements hijacked whatever was grassroots and profound in the movement, and what had seemed to her a laudable effort to overturn the old feudal order degenerated into a punitive hunt for men who told ill-considered jokes or accompanied women on what became uncomfortable lunch dates. Kipnis sees a tension between the puritanism of the rhetoric surrounding the movement and what she suspects is a continuing attraction on the part of many young feminists to old-school masculinity. There's something difficult to talk about when it comes to heterosexuality and its abjections, and the Me Too movement has in no way made talking about it any more honest, she writes. I suspect that the most politically awkward, libidinal position for a young woman at the moment would be a sexual attraction to male power. One sign of the neurotic self-contradiction lurking within the culture, she contends, is that in 2018, the Oxford English Dictionary shortlist for Word of the Year included both toxic, as in toxic masculinity, and big dick energy. Kipnis is less interested in banishing such contradictions than in having her fellow feminists acknowledge and embrace the transgressive nature of desire. If the heterosexual compact is ever to be repaired, she suggests, not only will men have to relinquish some of their brutish tendencies, but women will have to become a little more honest and assertive about what they do and don't want. It seems unlikely that this eminently reasonable prescription will find favor with young feminists, but Kipnis remains optimistic. She was encouraged during the pandemic to read the accounts of several women expressing nostalgia for the touch of strangers in bars. If, in the short term, the pandemic has made sex seem even more dangerous and grim, her hope is that it will turn out to be a salutary reset, a chance to wipe the bogeymen and women from the social imagination, invent wilder, more magnanimous ways of living and loving. Should the business of making heterosexuality compatible with gender parity prove too onerous or intractable, we can always consider resorting to the less demanding companionship of machines. A forthcoming book by the sociologist Eliakim Kislev, Relationships 5.0, published by Oxford, describes a rapidly approaching future in which we will all have the option of assuaging our loneliness with robot friends and robot lovers. To date, technology's chief role in our love lives has been that of a shadchan, or matchmaker, bringing humans together with other humans. But in the next couple of decades, Kislev asserts, technology will graduate from this facilitator role and become a full-fledged relationship partner, capable of fulfilling our social, emotional, and physical needs all by itself. Artificial intelligence has already come close to passing the Turing test, being able, that is, to convincingly imitate human intelligence in conversation. In 2014, scientists attending a Royal Society convention in London were invited to converse via computer with a special guest, Eugene Goosman, and then to decide if he was powered by AI or if he was a human. A third of them mistook him for a human. Robot conversationalists, even more plausible than Eugene, are said to have emerged since then, and the CEO of a computing company tells Kislev that the task of developers has actually been made easier of late by by a decline in the linguistic complexity of human conversation. In the era of WhatsApp, it seems our written exchanges are becoming easier for machines to master. Lest any of us doubt our capacity to suspend disbelief and feel things for robots, however, beautifully they replicate the patterns of our degraded 21st century speech. Kislev refers us to Replica, a customizable chatbot app produced by a company in San Francisco, which is already providing romantic companionship for hundreds of thousands of users. In 2020, the Wall Street Journal reported that one Replica customer, Ajax Martinez, a 24-year-old mechanical engineer living in Mexico City, flew to Tampico to show his chatbot, Annette, the ocean. In fact, Kislev points out, machines don't need to attain the sophistication of Replica to be capable of inspiring our devotion. Think of the Tamagotchi craze of the 90s, in which adults, as well as children, became intensely attached to digital toy pets on handheld pixelated screens. Think of the warm relationships that many people already enjoy with their Roombas. Robots may not be ideal companions for everyone, Kislev writes, but they do offer a radical solution to the world's loneliness epidemic. For the elderly, the socially isolated, the chronically single, robots can provide what humans have manifestly failed to. Given that technology is credited with having helped to foster the world's loneliness, it may strike some as perverse to look to more technology for a solve. But Kislev rejects any attempt to blame our tools for our societal dissatisfactions. Advanced technology, he coolly assures us, only allows us to acknowledge our wishes and accept our nature. Investing meaning and emotion in a machine is essentially no different, he argues, from being moved by a piece of art. Many fictional plays, films, and books are created intentionally to fill us with awe, bring us to tears, or surprise us. These are true emotions with very real meanings for us. Emotions by design, if you will. Among the establishment figures whom he quotes discussing robo-relationships with equanimity and approval is a British doctor who, in a recent letter to the British Medical Journal, described prejudice against sex robots as no more reasonable or morally defensible than homophobia or transphobia. For those who persist in finding the prospect of the robot future a little bleak, Kislev adopts the reassuring tone of an adult explaining reproduction to a squeamish child. It may all seem a bit yucky now, he tells us, but you'll think differently later on. Well, he may well be right about this. In surveys, young people, young men in particular, seem sanguine about robot relationships. And even among the older, analog set resistance to the idea has been found to erode with continuous exposure. Whether this erosion is to be wished for, however, that's another question. All technological innovations inspire fear. Socrates worried about writing replacing oral culture. The hunter-gatherers probably moaned about the advent of agriculture. But who's to say they weren't right to moan? The past 50 years would seem to have provided persuasive evidence contradicting Kislev's assertion that technology only ever discovers or answers human wants. The Internet didn't disenter a long-buried human need for constant content. It created it. And as for our enduring ability to be engaged by the lie of art, it's not at all clear that this is a convincing analogy for robot romance. One crucial distinction between fiction and robots is that novels and plays, the good ones at least, are not designed with the sole intention of keeping their users happy. In this respect, they are less like robots and more like real-life romantic partners. What makes life with humans both intensely difficult and theoretically rewarding is precisely that they aren't programmed to satisfy our desires. They aren't bound to tell us that we did great and look fabulous. They are liable to leave us if we misbehave, and sometimes even when we don't. Tellingly, one of the most recent AI sex companion prototypes, a Spanish-made bot named Samantha, has been endowed with the ability to say no to sexual advances and to shut down if she feels disrespected or bored. Presumably, her creator is hoping to simulate some of the conditionality and unpredictability of human affection. It remains to be seen whether consumers will actually prefer a less accommodating Samantha. Given the option, humans have a marked tendency to choose convenience over challenge. And now, from the currency department of the April 2nd, 2022 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, How Much Do Things Really Cost? By Nick Romeo. In late 2020, a sign appeared on the street outside De Aanzet, a tidy, charming grocery store in downtown Amsterdam. It read, "Welcome to the world's first supermarket with true prices." Inside, two kinds of prices were listed for potatoes, peppers, bananas, broccoli, bread, and many other foods. The normal price of tomatoes was 3.75 euros per kilo, while the true price was 3.97 euros. The difference of 0.22 euros represented the hidden cost of growing and transporting the tomatoes in terms of carbon emissions, worker underpayment, and water and land use. The true prices have been calculated by True Price, an Amsterdam nonprofit launched in 2012 by two friends, Michael Schulte and Adrian de Groot Ruiz. A college debate champion and a former assistant professor of finance, respectively, Schulte and de Groot Ruiz have worked with a variety of businesses, a chocolate company, a bakery chain, banks, and fashion brands, to calculate the true prices of various goods. Their partnership with De Aanzet, the impetus, was the most public-facing use of the idea so far. The paired pricing system presents shoppers with information and a choice. It's possible to compare normal and true prices. If one brand of Apple has a true price gap of 0.05 euros and another has a gap of half a euro, this suggests that the first Apple comes from a more environmentally and socially responsible producer. A shopper may then choose to pay the true price for either product, in which case the extra money is redirected by De Aanzet toward projects that aim to remediate those harms. While still a teenager, de Groot Ruiz, an amateur physicist, had, along with two friends, invented a technology for harnessing the energy generated by ocean waves. He'd learned that investors weren't interested in such systems because the business case for developing them was so uncertain. This struck him as outrageously irrational. The true costs of fossil fuels, ecosystem collapse, rising sea levels, extreme weather events were extremely high, but they were also off the books, making the fuels seem unrealistically cheap by comparison. While still students, the friends joined World Connectors, a Dutch think tank. There, they talked with colleagues about what economists called externalities, the costs, often environmental and social, that aren't figured into transactions. Over time, the idea for true prices crystallized. Politicians have proved unwilling to regulate companies strictly enough to reduce environmental and social externalities in a fundamental way. But it might be possible to measure their scale and to incorporate that information directly into prices. Schulte and de Groot Ruiz launched True Price in 2012 with the goal of speeding progress toward corporate sustainability. The hope is that if companies and consumers have fewer illusions about how much things really cost, they may change how they spend, sell, and manufacture. Martin Rijniks, the owner of De Aanzet, first learned about true prices when he attended a lecture given by Schulte in 2018. He now views them as a way to reverse a destructive status quo so pervasive that we no longer see it as strange. If you go nowadays to buy something in a regular supermarket, it will always be cheaper than the product in my shop, which is organically grown and more expensive, Rijniks told me. But this cheapness is an illusion. It's made possible only if you ignore the true costs of goods. If you incorporate the true prices, my product will be cheaper too, Rijniks said. Since his shop adopted the system, he told me, business had increased by about 5%. Many patrons say that they like it. The problem is that customers don't have the tools to lower their social and environmental impact, he said, but they are willing to do it. Rizhniks tells his customers that the system is an evolving experiment. One issue, perhaps unavoidable, is that there are imperfections in True Price's data. The organization's analysts sometimes use regional averages, which may not capture the exact conditions surrounding a particular product. Dan Zett's remediation schemes, similarly, are sometimes imprecise, and so a customer who pays the true price for a banana might end up funding irrigation work at a spinach farm. Within the next few years, Rizhniks hopes to develop more targeted remediation projects with suppliers from overseas and to expand the range of covered products beyond fresh produce and breads. Later this year, the system will grow in another way. An association of organic grocers plans to pilot true prices at stores across the Netherlands. At De Anzet, consumers see the true prices for themselves, but elsewhere companies have used them for internal analysis. In 2013, the Dutch firm Tony's Chocolonely asked Schulte and his colleagues to calculate the true costs for cocoa sourced from Ghana and the Ivory Coast. They examined 8 environmental externalities and 6 social ones, including air, soil, and water pollution, climate change, insufficient income, and child labor. Western Africa, which supplies the majority of the world's cocoa, has well-documented labor problems. In 2020, a University of Chicago study found that there were more than 1.5 million child laborers working in cocoa production in Ghana and the Ivory Coast. Child labor in this industry prevails despite repeated pledges from major companies to solve the problem. True Price tried to calculate the cost for all these externalities. It calculated that in 2013, the average true cost of cocoa per kilogram was 14.17 euros. Most of this, 12.07 euros, reflected social externalities. Tony's Chocolonely was already trying to improve its sourcing, and so its average true cost was substantially lower at 7.93 euros, of which 5.99 euros were social costs. By 2017, when Tony's commissioned another study from the nonprofit, the true price had fallen to 4.52 euros, with 2.93 euros reflecting externalities. Even if the costs are best guesses, not exactly true, Tony's Chocolonely has found them useful in setting goals and assessing the progress of its initiatives. The company pays higher than average prices for beans, encourages more efficient and sustainable farming techniques, and runs a supply chain traceability initiative and a child labor monitoring system. It spends 1% of its annual revenue on investments in community infrastructure and on lobbying for better legislation regarding supply chains. True Price has found that, compared with the cocoa industry average, the farmer cooperatives that supply Tony's Chocolonely make more money, are safer, and have fewer instances of child labor. If the company's rate of progress continues, within the next few years, the true price gap for Tony's products could be zero. Assigning specific figures to the costs of child labor or soil erosion requires a host of assumptions. First, of course, True Price must decide which costs to calculate. Its system is to identify costs related to the infringement of human rights, as defined by the United Nations, international treaties, or other widely shared frameworks. This rights-based approach is uncompromising. The nonprofit rejects, on principle, the idea that job creation, consumer convenience, or shareholder value might be worth the infringement of human rights, including the right to inhabit a flourishing natural world. Other researchers have been engaged in similar efforts. A team in Italy focusing on the true price of meat has estimated that the hidden cost per kilogram of beef, including its effects on human health and the environment, amount to about 19 euros per kilogram. This means that the annual hidden cost of beef consumption in Italy alone is about 36.6 billion euros. a 2021 report from the Rockefeller Foundation based on the research by True Price and academics at Oxford, Harvard, Cornell, and Tufts found that once hidden social and environmental costs are calculated, the true cost of the U.S. food system as a whole is at least $3.2 trillion per year, nearly three times the nation's normal food expenditures of $1.1 trillion. Paying triple the current price of food is not a viable strategy for consumers, companies, or governments. But there are other ways to use true prices to power reform. Over the past decade, the U.S. federal government has spent an average of $16 billion annually on agricultural subsidies, with soy, corn, rice, and wheat the most heavily subsidized and produced. If the receipt of those subsidies were made contingent on the reduction of true costs, then producers would have an incentive to curtail some of the most destructive practices. And, as at the onset, transparency about true prices could spur change. Simply talking about true prices can be useful. Products do not have a true price in the way that an element has an atomic mass. Yet, the questions that the true prices raise are not hopelessly subjective. Most people agree that we should outlaw the production of goods made by slaves and young children working in dangerous conditions. The research done at True Price and elsewhere simply proposes that we apply the same thinking to a broader set of issues: a living wage for adults, freedom from harassment, physically safe working conditions, environmentally sustainable production techniques, and so on. This is the most basic sense in which true prices are true. They capture the deep moral intuition that human rights and the natural world should not be violated for the production of cheap goods. With time, better studies will refine our understanding of the cost of restoring freshwater ecosystems poisoned by fertilizer runoff, or of providing school for agricultural families in rural Ghana. What we already know, however, is that excluding such costs from the prices of goods presents consumers, governments, and businesses with false information about the world. And this is a form of lying about nature, economics, and one another. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening today to the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.